Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear about a book that could be the perfect companion on the next snow day with your kids. Stephen Volz and Fritz Groba might be familiar to them. They're the guys that make viral science project videos and are best known for their Coke and Mentos experiments, in which they create Coke geysers from placing Mentos inside of a 2-liter Diet Coke. The resultant geyser shoots up as high as 20 feet. Volz and Groba are an interesting part of the do-it-yourself Maker Faire set for their videos, which make science fun and are fun to watch. Now the founders of E.P. Bird Studios have put together a book of 25 do-it-yourself science experiments titled How to Build a Hovercraft, Air Cannons, Magnet Motors, and 25 Do-It-Yourself Science Projects. Each are accompanied by step-by-step instructions with an explanation of the scientific principles at work and range from simple optical illusions to a leaf blower-powered hovercraft to a Coke and Mentos-powered mini rocket car. My guest today is Stephen Volz, and since their first viral video, they've appeared on talk shows around the country, received 4 Webby Awards, and their videos have been seen by an estimated 150 million viewers. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Stephen Volz, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Many people might have seen your appearances on various television shows from E.P. Bird Laboratories. And now you guys have come up with this book, which is a great way to spend a winter weekend kind of having fun. It's called How to Build a Hovercraft. Give us a sense of how this book came together.
Sure. After we did our first Coke and Mentos videos and that thing went wild on the internet, we were looking for more experiments. We sort of went on a quest for more cool experiments, but they had to be with everyday objects. So we looked all over the internet. We talked to all of our friends that we knew. We know a lot of circus performers and variety performers. And we went to libraries and looked actually on our own shelves. We've been gathering books of sort of this type for years. And we collected a bunch of really cool sort of parlor tricks and science experiments that had the potential, we thought, to maybe be another video someday. And as we worked on them, we realized, because you take a little simple thing like a paper airplane or whatever and try to develop it into a bigger piece. And as we worked on them, we realized we were doing a lot of science just to make the airplane fly farther or the geyser shoot higher. And we thought, science classes ought to be here with us because this is a way more fun to do science than reading Chapter 11, reading those formulas and memorizing them. And that was sort of the genesis of the book, was to take the stuff that was first just things we thought were really cool and fun to do, like building a hovercraft or shooting off Coke and Mentos geysers, and then pay some real attention to the science afterwards so you could do fun things and really understand how they worked.
Since you mentioned the Coke and Mentos experiment, for those who don't know the Coke and Mentos experiment, if you drop a Mentos into a room temperature 2-liter of Coke, stand back because you're going to get a big geyser of about 20-25 feet maybe at some times.
Yeah, you can get 10 or 15 feet without even closing down the nozzle, and if you drop 4 or 5 Mentos in, and often what we'll do is we'll keep the cap on and we'll drill a little hole so it's only a 1/4-inch hole, and that will definitely shoot 20-25 feet.
Wow.
No shaking the bottle required. It's really quite amazing.
And I always thought that was some sort of chemical reaction because of the compositions of Mentos, thinking along the lines of the lifesaver, you know, in the closet, the mint lifesaver that gives off a little electric.
A little green glow.
Yeah, a little green glow. But in fact, it has nothing to do with that. Why does a Mentos cause this geyser to come up?
This was really surprising to us as we dug more into it. It turns out that, first of all, any fizzy beverage will work. We use Diet Coke and Diet Sodas because there's no sugar in them, and when we get covered in the spray, the cleanup is really easy. It's not sticky. But what makes the CO2 come out so fast is the shape of the surface of the Mentos, because it turns out that when CO2 is forced into a liquid like seltzer water or Coke or whatever, it wants to gather on any rough surface. So you might notice if you put your finger and just hold it in a cup of 7-Up or something, you can see that bubbles will start to form on the ridges of your fingerprints.
Right.
Or they'll form on the crack in the glass before they form on the sides of the glass. They're attracted to that rough surface. And it turns out, just by a fluke, that Mentos have hundreds of thousands of really tiny little bumps all over them. We got a chance to go to the factory in the Netherlands where they're made a few years ago. And we saw that at the very end of the process, just to make them taste the way they want them to taste, they tumble them in these giant sort of dryers like rock tumblers, and they spray them with a mist of liquid sugar. And our theory is that that liquid sugar mist hardens into tiny little droplets, little bumps, and that's what makes the surface so bumpy. And it's those bumps, the shape of the Mentos, that make the reaction happen.
Now, when I was thinking about that, I was thinking if it is the rough surface, then it should work with any sort of rough, very rough.
Yes, and in fact, it will. What works really well is rock salt also works well because it's got a good bumpy surface.
Oh, really?
You can drop lots of different things in. Mentos are good because they're both super bumpy, they're the right size to fit to the bottle opening, and they're heavy enough that they sink all the way to the bottom so they get the reaction all the way through the whole 2-liter bottle. When we were first experimenting with different kinds of candies, and we did try everything we could find on the shelves, when we realized it was a surface area, we thought, oh, those little pastel mints that you get in a little teaspoon at some restaurants on your way out
would
be perfect because, like, chalky. And we drop those in, waiting for this huge explosion, and they just float on the surface because they're so light. They're not dense enough. So it's the combination of the density and the weight and the nice bumpy surface is what makes for that super good reaction.
And then I was thinking of something like pumice stone, but that might be the same problem, like a lava rock or something like that. But that
It would start the reaction, but it would probably float. I've heard that there's like activated charcoal, but even that, if it's too porous, then it'll float.
Interesting. Well, the first section of the book is like really small things that you can do. Some show off optical illusions, looking at a spinning, a whirling hypnosis wheel, and how that shows makes your head appear to grow when you stare at a head afterwards. One of the most interesting was the self-crushing can. And this gets into idea of how air expands and moves faster under heat and how it doesn't. And explain the self-crushing can.
This one I love particularly because I remember it from having my sixth grade teacher show it to us in class. And if you take you can use like a paint thinner can, those big rectangular couple gallon cans, or any can actually, but those paint thinner ones are really good. And you put about just a little bit of water over the bottom, just enough to sort of cover the bottom of the can. And you heat it up until you start to see steam coming out of the top. If you then cap the can, screw the cap on nice and tight, and cool down from the outside by spraying with water or putting in a bucket of ice water, that can will crush very dramatically, really quickly, and it involves a huge amount of force, something you couldn't really do with your hands. And what's happening is that when the steam starts to come out, all of that, it pushes out all the air that's in there. The gas, the water turns to steam, and the steam takes up more space as a gas than it does when it condenses. So it's full of steam with a little tiny strip of water on the bottom. And when you cool the can from the outside, the steam all condenses back into water and takes up a lot less space. And then it's the air pressure, the air molecules that are all around us all the time that are pressing on us that we don't notice because we're pressing back just as hard. There's nothing pressing back anymore, and those air molecules slam into the can and crush it like a giant invisible fist.
Now, you can do this with something as small as a Coke can again.
You can. It's great, actually. You can do it with a Coke can, and you can just hold the Coke can over the burner, let the steam come out, and then you hold the Coke can with tongs so you don't burn your fingers. Then just turn it upside down, and then the steam will stay in there. It'll be rising up toward the bottom of the can, and put that in a thing of ice water, and that thing will crush like an invisible jolly green giant is just smashing it in his hand.
Of course,
very dramatic and super easy to do.
Of course, this lets kids know what like the effects of space or deep ocean.
Yep.
My guest today is Stephen Volz. He is the co-founder of E.P. Bird Laboratory in Maine. He and his colleague Fritz Groba have co-authored How to Build a Hovercraft, Amazing Do-It-Yourself Science Projects, and they're very much a part of the do-it-yourself movement. Another one, another very easy one is to take a bar of ivory soap and create the ivory volcano. This sounds like this is a lot of fun, but it could be very messy very quickly.
It's actually not that messy if you're careful, and it is probably the easiest thing in the book. You just take a bar of ivory soap, and we usually cut it in half because it makes for a little bit more manageable size, but you can use a full bar, and put it in your microwave for 30, 45 seconds, and it will puff up into this sort of lava-shaped morph that's maybe 5 to 10 times the size of an ordinary bar of soap. And then when you take it out, it's dry and soft to the touch. And if you push on it with any strength, it'll just turn to powder. It just turns to dust because of all the same amount of soap that's there, just in a bigger mass.
Now, is that how they make fake snow? Is that one of the ways they make...
You know, I don't know how they make fake snow, but it makes really good fake snow.
Yeah, that's. I think I've seen it used that way. And so basically, it's the same principle as the can, right? Pretty much.
Yeah, what happens is the ivory soap's got little it's whipped as it's made, and so it's got lots of little bubbles in it, and it's got a little bit of moisture in it. So when you heat it in the microwave, the little bubbles do the same thing that they do when they're in the can. Those little bubbles with the water inside turns to steam and starts to expand. And at the same time, the walls of the soap start to melt and soften, so they can expand. So they sort of blow up like 10,000 little tiny balloons inside that soap bar, and that changes the shape of the bar, and it just begins to blub and blub and blub until it's just five times as big as it started out. But it's all just soap, and as long as you're careful with the temperature, it's very, very safe and easy to do.
And now, another one that's also kind of interesting, and it's something that you kind of experiment with your kids at some point or another as you're teaching them about science or just having fun, is making a paper airplane. You come up with a paper airplane that can fly forever, quote, unquote.
I love that. That's not our design, but we were really happy to show people how it works. There are some paper airplane geniuses in the last 50 years or so. There's actually a patent on this airplane that will fly behind. If you walk behind it with a board, or if you're really good at something smaller, just walking behind it will create enough of an updraft that it will float and hover in front of you for as long as you can possibly walk. The guys who are really good at this, I've seen video of these guys, or at least one of them, he designed a plane. He just sort of drops it in front of him, and he has nothing in his hands, and he just walks behind it and uses his forehead, the little updraft from his forehead, to control it as if it's some kind of mind control. It's really amazing. But this is simply a piece of board, and almost anyone can learn to do it.
Now, is this something that the magician would use? Something like that?
Yeah, I've actually thought that you want to, from the magician brain, you want to misdirect a little bit from the cardboard. So if you just, I've always thought, if instead of using just a blank piece of cardboard or cutting board or something, if you make that into a sign that says, "This plane will fly forever," no one will think that the sign has anything to do with it. And you just walk behind it with a sign that says, "This plane will fly forever," and it will be really quite magical.
Now, it's called a tumblewing.
Yeah, this particular, there's a lot of different designs that will work like this, but the simplest one to make and the simplest one to fly is called a tumblewing. And you just use a really, really thin, light piece of paper. We recommend using a piece of paper from a phone book, if you can find a phone book. And it's about 6 or 7 inches long, and it's just flipped up on one end and flipped down the other end, maybe 2 inches wide, and it spins as it falls, and it sort of looks like a falling water wheel. And as long as there's that updraft, slight updraft from the board behind it, it will float in front of you spinning like a water wheel attached to nothing for as long as you can walk.
That's really interesting. Now, from the first section, which we've kind of described some of the easier ones, of course, the Coke Mentos in the second section, but you've got some great things that require a little more preparation, maybe a little more training, and a little more safety as well. And one of these things is firewire, which uses steel wool to create, in some way, homemade fireworks.
This is one I only recently learned about in the last few years, and it's really one of my favorites. Steel will burn, contrary to what you'd think, if you give it enough of the things you need for fire. You need enough air and enough circulation, and so steel wool is really good for making that light mesh. And it doesn't burn in a huge, big flame. Usually it burns up pretty slowly and want to go out. But if you tease it apart and make it as gauzy as possible, and then pack that gauze into a ball, and what we do is we put it inside a wire whisk and attach that wire whisk to a string. If you then light the steel wool and get that going, when you take that string and whip it around your head like a lariat, that starts to feed oxygen at a really high rate to the burning steel wool, and that makes it burn really furiously. But since it's such little threads of steel, you don't get big flames. They glow, turn to sparks, and fly off. So you get thousands and thousands of these beautiful flying sparks that go out before they hit the ground. So you get this little fireball. It's a great thing to do at night. And for 5 or 10 seconds, you get this gorgeous flaming steel spark show. The key to this is do it in a parking lot or on a beach or somewhere where it's not, those sparks aren't going to land on somewhere dry and start a fire. But it's really, really, you can do it in the street.
And a decent size rope so that you're not burning yourself.
Yes. Although the sparks are really, you want to be super careful, but those sparks are so small and they go out so quickly, it's really pretty safe.
Well, there's great pictures, and it's like, it makes it really dramatic, like a sparkler or almost like a fountain in a way.
Yeah, it's like if you took 500 sparklers and swung them around your head. It's this very dramatic. It lasts about 5 or 10 seconds. It doesn't go on for you know, a minute or two, but it's really a beautiful. We're actually brainstorming on a piece where we're going to use, I think, a handful of different people using them at the same time and trading off and making it sort of a dance piece with them. It's a really dramatic look.
My guest today is Stephen Voltz. He's the co-founder of E.P. Bird Laboratory. He and his colleague Fritz Grober have co-authored How to Build a Hovercraft, Amazing Do-It-Yourself Science Projects. Now, is E.P. Bird basically you guys sitting around thinking of cool things like that, that would look cool, that would make great videos, or is there some serious other, well, I'd call that serious work, but other serious work going on?
That, strange as it is, that is the core of what we do. The business is built around doing those kind of videos for brands and doing viral videos for brands like Coca-Cola and McDonald's and having crazy fun videos that are sponsored or have their brand message in it. But the core of the work is what's in the book. It's just finding cool, fun, crazy, Rube Goldberg-y kind of things to do with ordinary objects.
Now I'm looking at the one now for the bucket that turns into an air cannon.
Now, that's a lot of fun.
Now, okay, explain how this works. It's basically, it's a bucket with a handle on the bottom that you can actually send, a burst of air across a room.
Exactly right. If you just take pretty much any bucket, you close off the top with, a plastic from a garbage bag, so it's a little bit loose, completely covered in the top, and then cut a hole in what was the bottom of the bucket, you can bang on the plastic on the back and send out air vortex through that hole in what was the bottom. And the cool thing about those vortices are they're donut-shaped, and if you whack the back pretty hard, the air is moving very quickly, but it's not moving quickly in a forward direction. It's moving very quickly around the donut shape. So it's like a circular donut-shaped tornado where the wind is moving really quickly around the tornado, but the tornado itself may be moving fast or slow forward or sideways. So this thing moves forward at about, takes 3 or 4 seconds to get across the room, but the air inside is going really quickly. So if you whack the bucket, you can count 1,000, 2,000, 1,000, 3,000, 1,000, and then it'll blow out a candle on the other side of the room, and that delay is really kind of mind-bending.
That is cool, and it is cool, and you have instructions showing exactly how to go about building it, and you tell us the science behind it, which, you know, in this case, it sort of helps explains how tornadoes are, you know, you have a picture of a tornado in there. Now, let's get to the title, How to Build a Hovercraft, and this involves a leaf blower.
This is one of the most amazing, and really, even though it's a bigger project, one of the easier things in the book. It's more work than making the microwave soap and stuff, but you can do this, pretty much anyone can build one of these things in under an hour. You just need some plywood, some heavy-duty plastic, probably something heavier than garbage bag, but you can get some heavy plastic at the hardware store and get your plywood. You need a saw to cut off the edges and a drill to make some holes. And then you need to hook it up to a leaf blower in a very simple way, the way we show you in the book. And that will create a hovercraft that someone as big as me, and I am 6'1", well over 200 pounds, can stand on, and it will lift me up, and you can push me all over the room on that thing. And really, it's under an hour that can be made. It's just a really cool design.
Now, actually, you have a couple of other ideas, which is the tabletop hovercraft, which works with a compact disc and a balloon.
That you can make in about 15 seconds. It's a great starter.
And then the hairdryer hovercraft, which takes a paper plate, and you put the...
Yeah, we have like a small, medium, and large.
Yeah, that's really cool. I assume it's just blowing up enough air to make things come off the ground. It's hard to believe that the seal is such that it would make it work.
Yeah, what happens is you use the plastic to make a pillow under the plywood, and the leaf blower blows through the base of the plywood. The leaf blower is on the top where you're standing, and there's a hole where the nozzle of the leaf blower goes, and that blows through the plywood into the pocket, the air pocket the plastic makes. It covers the whole bottom. And then on the bottom of that plastic pillow, there's 6 holes about the size of a quarter. And out of those holes, the air continues to flow. And as long as the air that's coming in from the leaf blower on top is coming in as fast as the air that's going out the sides as you're standing on it, there'll be a cushion of air that you can float on. And that will go as long as you keep the leaf blower going.
Now, I think one of the most...
Like a human hockey puck.
Yeah, no, exactly. Now, I think one of the coolest of experiment is what you call the pendulum wave machine. this is requires a little bit of preparation, but the idea is simple, that gravity is a constant, and so you're going to put a bunch of strings on a bar overhead of varying lengths with some sort of weight. Doesn't matter if the weight's the same or different, but I think you used nuts on there, and you start them all together, synchronize them, and of course the varying lengths of the string will cause a variety of patterns as each takes a different amount of time to complete the pendulum, and then at some point down the road they all synchronize again, that's the cool part, I think.
Yeah, I think so. It's like a pendulum kaleidoscope. You get these really beautiful patterns, and then it looks like chaos for a while, and then a new pattern comes out, and it looks like chaos again, and then another pattern, and then eventually we'll go back and start the cycle all over again. It takes a little bit of patience to tune those links exactly right, so they all line up right, but it's very satisfying to do the work. Really pretty.
Now, you and your colleague Fritz are very much involved in the do-it-yourself movement and the maker movement. Explain, for those who are not familiar with the maker movement, what's going on with this whole maker movement? It's people are getting back to, you know, experimenting, having fun. A lot of times it is for videos like the way you do, but it's also just building things from scratch again because everything seems to be so automated now.
That's exactly right. We're just a little tiny part of it. We make these do-it-yourself video kind of stuff, and we always try and share with people how we make the geysers or the sticky nut waterfalls or whatever we're doing. But the maker movement in general is more just a movement of realizing that you, whoever you are at home, can hack everything you've got. You can take apart your bicycle, you can take apart your laptop, you can take apart your stove or your, and learn to fix it and change it and redesign it. And there's a whole community of people that are doing this all over the world, really. And the maker fairs are a place where people come together and teach each other what they're doing. It's really an exciting, empowering DIY sharing kind of world, and we're really happy to be part of it.
My guest today, Stephen Volz, co-founder of the E.P. Bird Laboratory, make videos, and he and his colleague have co-authored a book, How to Build a Hovercraft, amazing do-it-yourself science projects. It'd be great for like a weekend to just kind of do something. It shows the kids some great scientific projects, and they have a lot of fun in the meantime. And I guess that's really what you guys are sort of, a lot of your involvement is the fun factor, it looks like.
That's really what drives it. I mean, we had the rule was, it's not getting in the book unless we think it's really fun. And then after that, well, there's science behind everything, so let's pick the good stuff and just do the science on the fun stuff. So it's awesome first, and then secondarily, well, now we've just got something awesome. Here's how it works. And we do spend some time describing the science, explaining how it all fits together.
Now, I know video is a big part of what you're doing. What's the most recent video you guys done that we might see, either for a client or for fun for yourself?
We've been spending a lot of time on books lately. We did some stuff for a Coke and McDonald's. It was in Europe, but if you look online, you can see some stuff. We're not in it, but our lab superstar, Shane McClan, is in it doing some really cool Rube Goldberg kind of contraptions to put a straw in a Coke glass. And those are kind of fun.
Yeah.
And like I say, we're working on some stuff, particularly something I'm really interested to see what the FireWire project's going to look like. We scale that up from more than one to several.
This is the idea of creating a choreographed piece involving the steel wool. Yeah. Well, that's exciting, and I assume it'll be online once it comes out?
That's where we put stuff.
The name of the book is How to Build a Hovercraft, Amazing Do-It-Yourself Science Projects. Stephen Volz, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Stephen Volz is a co-founder of E.P. Bird Laboratory. He and his other co-founder, Fritz Groba, make viral science videos and now have collaborated on the book, How to Build a Hovercraft, Air Cannons, Magnet Motors, and 25 Other Amazing Do-It-Yourself Science Projects. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Connie Cronley.
It seems to me that at one time or another, we become fascinated by our own family tree. We want to know more about our ancestors. We may want to do genealogical research. We may even want to write a family history. I'm sure there's a deep philosophical reason for this, the need to leave a footprint on the earth, or the dread of time's winged chariot overhead. But maybe it's just that we finally have time to take a breath in life and wonder how in the world we got to be like we are. Most of our family histories are interesting only to us, like photos of our vacation or an accounting of our dream last night. But I have read a family history a journalist wrote, and he turned it into a page-turning book. The author is Lee Sandlin, and the title of the book is The Distancers. Isn't that one of the worst titles you've ever heard? It refers to his family's being non-communicative. They didn't want to talk about themselves. But boy, does Mr. Sandlin tell their stories, generations of their stories. I particularly like the one of a quiet man whose long-suffering grievances with his brother-in-law erupted into a fistfight on the stairs, and they never spoke to one another again, although they lived together in the same house for 17 more years. Now, there are people who can sharpen a grudge to a sharp edge. I like the book so much, I'm toying with the idea of writing one myself about my own family, especially about my great-grandmother, Eliza Young. I knew her and my great-grandfather. They were tiny, quiet people. I have a black brooch that belonged to her and an antique light fixture from their home. I remember my great-grandmother as always wearing a black dress, but it turns out that memory isn't accurate at all. All the photos show her wearing a spring-like flowered dress. Long after everyone involved was dead, I discovered a scandalous secret about her. My great-grandparents and three of their children were living on a farm in Missouri when Eliza began a romance with a neighbor man. More than a romance, an affair. Relatives said they used to meet down by the creek. When her husband found out, he yanked the family out of Missouri and moved to Oklahoma, and that is where their fourth child, my great-uncle Vernon, was born. Well, no wonder he didn't look like the rest of the family, people whispered. He was the love child. Another relative said, oh, no, it wasn't a neighbor. It was her husband's brother she had the affair with. He was the father of Uncle Vernon. Well, anyway, there was a big blow-up, and the brother moved to California and was never heard from again. Or did he move? Did he just ominously disappear? This lurid history doesn't match at all the old people I remember. This story has all the makings of a colorful novel or movie, not families. But then I took another look at the family genealogy, and Uncle Vernon's birth date didn't jive at all with this tale. So maybe none of this is true. Maybe Uncle Vernon was just taller than the rest of the family, and that's what ginned up this juicy story. But then again, in 1890, my great-grandmother had named her first child, her daughter, Nellie Bly. This was my own grandmother. Nellie Bly Young, named after the most famous woman journalist and adventurer of her time. So maybe my great-grandmother Eliza had a private fantasy life, dreams and aspirations. Maybe on a farm with four children and a sour husband, she couldn't live her dreams. But maybe she hoped her children would. And so she named her daughter Nellie Bly and hoped she could fly away to adventure. Maybe that's the story.
Connie Cronley is the executive director of Iron Gate, as well as a writer, essayist, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just find Studio Tulsa and you can look through our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.